I used to be like, I'm a poet slash business person slash this slash that. And then my dad was like, you're doing a whole lot. Why don't you just be a writer? And the people who are most successful at being a writer, they just write.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Poet Kelly Harris DeBerry joins us today. She is the author of the poetry collection, Freedom Knows My Name. On this episode, Kelly discusses why she prefers to forego the polished for the real, plus why she said she was pushed into poetry by friends and the ancestors.
I'm not consumed with, you know, I want to be in this publication or that publication. That's not really my style. I do what the poem requires.
Doing what the poem requires has landed Kelly fellowships from the Fine Arts Work Center and the prestigious Cave Canem. But before the fellowships and MFA, before the book and magazine bylines, or even her own business, what Kelly says she realized at a young age about her passion for words and language when Black and Published continues.
So we're just going to jump right into it. First question, when did you know that you were a writer?
Well, I grew up in the Black church, and I grew up in a church that had a culture and an expectation of children to learn Easter, Christmas speeches, verse, poetry. And so I grew up very early sitting with text, thinking about memorizing text, reciting text, thinking about how my voice sounded with text, all of those things. And also being prepped for what happens if the mic is wrong, right? You know, because every church has a mic you got to tap, you know. So all of those things were very early on in my life. And then even the Black preachers, the missionaries, the evangelists, the folks who stood up and testified, they were also kind of like my first spoken word artist, the way they admonished the word of God and also bent the word to reclaim language and reclaim the storytelling in our own vernacular, in our own way, the way that they retold the stories of Jesus, if you will, you know, from their perspectives was always inspiring. So I think those were my precursors for being a poet. And then I had two wonderful grandmothers who were masterful at verbal shorthand. And, you know, they would say, you know, I remember my grandmother would always say, don't speak with your mind full, you know, meaning, you know, like we say, don't speak with your mouth full, don't speak with your mind full, don't be wise with what you say, you know, and what you're thinking, you know. And my other grandmother, you know, I remember when she was trying to poke around to see if I was having sex, she was at her kitchen table, you know, at her kitchen sink cleaning greens. And she looked up at me and said, you know, if you're doing the do, something gonna get done. And and that was like, you know, all these little shorthand things were just like they could talk to you and it just popped. And at the time, I didn't realize, I just thought those were my grandmothers, but they were wonderful poets. And it always reminds me of Paul Marshall's, you know, the Poet's Kitchen piece that she has. And so those were like the precursors. And then the formal education of learning and loving libraries and going to school and all of those things. So that might be a long answer to your question, but it is really, those were really the building blocks for my love of language.
I love that answer. First of all, shout out to all the grandmothers who have no shame and have lived long enough to say what they're going to say. And you just got to accept it and be embarrassed no matter what. I love that. But in sitting with texts like Bible verses, doing Easter speeches and Christmas speeches and things like that, and hearing the poetry that can come from a pulpit when pastors, especially in a Black church, are interpreting the text, how did that fuel you to write your own poems and tell your own stories in that same tradition?
You know, I think it has, it's a large influence on me, and not necessarily always in the religious sense, but in the sense of being able to connect to people, being able to try to conjure a spirit space as a poet, to be able to kind of create a world, to speak the word in a way that I am in alignment with God, the people, and myself, right? And so there's always an accountability in my work in my head about what am I, how am I speaking, am I speaking in truth? And all of those things come from that place, those early years of, you know, getting my hair pressed and curled and, you know, my ruffled socks and patent leather shoes, but critical to the way that I value audience and readers.
So in seeking out that alignment, when did it all come together for you that this would be something that you would dedicate your life to?
I think it's still coming together. You know, I have seasons. I've been in various seasons as a poet where I was writing poetry, but I wasn't really saying that I was a poet, all of those things. But I think maybe the turning point was in college at Kent State University. I was begged to be in the Black United Students pageant, which is kind of our homecoming celebration for Black folks. And they were like, we need another contestant. And they were begging me. And I was like, I don't have a talent. I just write poetry. You know, I don't sing, you know, dance, anything like that. And they were like, well, just do that then. And I did it not thinking I was going to win. I was just filling in the space and I won. And from there, people on campus were like, that's the poet, or girl, you got another poem, or, you know, that kind of thing. And so that was kind of like the turn where I knew that because I had publicly won something, I couldn't go back.
So it's basically like you were trying to do somebody a solid and then the Lord put you on Front Street, like, oh, you also have talent that you are not acknowledging.
Yeah. And I think at the time, talent was considered this really physical thing you could do, you know, dance, sing, pop lock, whatever the case may be. And I didn't see it at that time as on the same level of being able to be in a talent show back then. But I think that's changing these days. Yeah.
So once you became known as the poet on campus, did that change anything in what you were doing as far as what you were majoring in, what you wanted to do for work, for life, or just how you saw this thing you dabbled in on the side as, no, this is a thing?
Sure. I started off in magazine journalism. Kent State has a great journalism program. So I started there. But when I came to Kent State, I had one of the things I chose Kent State was it had a strong Pan-African Studies department. It was one of the first Pan-African Studies departments in the country. And so I felt that although I wasn't going to HBCU, I could get a really strong Black experience there. And I did. And my father was going back to school at the time, or had gone back a couple years before. And he used to bring me these magazines that the Black United Students were producing called Uhuru Magazine. And as a high schooler, I was reading this magazine and they had a poetry section. And believe it or not, guess who the editor was at that time? Krista Franklin. And I didn't know Krista Franklin, but as a high schooler, I was like, poetry editor, I think I want to do that. I don't think I was a poet. I love the poetry section of this magazine. And so when I got to today, I was looking for Uhuru magazine, even though I didn't think I was a writer. I just wanted to do it. And so I became the poetry editor there. And so I really just worked with words and thought about words, but I still didn't make the connection that I was being a writer at that time.
So you went from an undergrad being the poetry editor of Uhuru magazine to fact-checking obituaries to working at American Greetings. So when you were at American Greetings, were you on the creative side or in a different department?
I wanted so badly to work in the greeting card section department, but they placed me in corporate communications. And although I really always hated the fact that I never got into the creative department, I feel like today those skills that I learned in corporate communications has helped me think about the business side of writing and publishing. My job, I think in my head, is to, you know, I try to sell books, but my work is writing.
So when did the work of writing really take off for you? Was it before or after you got into the Cave Canem Fellowship?
You talk about imposter syndrome. I had a big time at Cave Canem because I was just so amazed at the work that people were producing. But it made me a better poet, and it made me a patient poet. Mm. Understood, I really had a lot of work to do.
If you don't mind my asking, what year was that?
2005.
Okay. So in 2005, you felt like you had this imposter syndrome around all these other poets who seemed to be further than where you were. Do you still have imposter syndrome now in 2021? Even though you have kind of you have established yourself in the poetry world and with your pen?
Yes to no. I still doubt myself at times, which I think most artists do. I wish I knew now what then, meaning that the publishing game is very difficult, and that you know, you can have a name and not really move a lot of books, that a lot of writers are really unhappy, you know. I wish that I knew how masterful and understood how masterful Black folks' language was, right? In the sense, like, you know, going to get an MFA and all those things, that all the things that I really needed that I was trying to tap into were already there. I had already learned it through my grandmother's, you know, Toni Morrison talks about, I think in her essay, Rootedness, the anthology, that, you know, our ancestors are not parents, they're timeless people, right? And so that has given me a lot of peace, just knowing that it's a real struggle. And so what you see on, you know, in public, you know, the writing lives of people, it's not as sparkly as I thought it was in 2005. Like, you know, the struggle is real. And I wish that I understood that better then.
So did you go and get your MFA after you went to Cave Canem and then started to go into things that way? How did that work?
But I went to grad school because I thought that that was something I had to do. That if I wanted to be a writer, I really had to go to school for it. I feel like I benefited from it later than when I actually graduated, you know. I had a hard time in graduate school. I was the only Black person in the program. I had moments where I was, you know, to quote the Clark sisters, is my living in vain? You know, I was like, you know, this MFA really, you know, what is this about? Is this in vain? I'm here. I spend more time trying to explain myself than writing. And this gets to the book. This is really like the energy of the book. I remember I was in graduate school and we had this public reading, and I was sitting there with my folks who came to support me. My mama was sitting right beside me, and we sat through white poet after white poet after white poet after white poet, and, you know, the Iowa Farms and all of these things. And when it was time for me to read, I read some stuff, but it was so polished. It was so, you know, neat. It was so neat. It was so on me, really. It wasn't the authentic Kelly. And I knew that, and I felt like my folks knew that, but they didn't say it. They were just like clapping, you know? And I felt just like a drop in my spirit with that, because I knew I was seemingly moving on and doing well, getting an MFA, but it wasn't working. Something wasn't clicking. And so I like vowed at that point that, you know, whatever first book I did, it was going to be a book that my mother could sit through, that my people could sit through, and they could feel and see themselves in it. And so that was like really important to me that I do that. So the book is not trying to, I think I'm trying to like win awards or show off any of the things you learn in MFA. I really just wanted to make a book that my folks, like the people that know me, you know, could be proud of. So when I say that Freedom Knows My Name, it is really, I'm saying it to myself that, that freedom knows who I am, and whatever my personal freedom and the collective freedom that our people are always in pursuit of.
Okay. So then let's get to the book, because what I noticed immediately, especially by like poem 3 or 4, is that the collection is rooted in Southern tradition, Southern living, and then Black life and what that history entails, however painful that is. Was it intentional for you to tell a story like that? Because like Mama Say made me really sad, but then listening to the labor and contraction poem, it was like, okay, we've got a whole birth to death experience here throughout the whole collection.
Yeah. Mama Say is kind of a wink to Eloise Greenfield and Honey, I Love. I feel strongly about, we've gotten away from these poems that children can recite, you know, back to the church thing. You know, I have a daughter, she's 8. And when they had a poetry project, and I found it very, I had to go back to like the Langston Hughes stuff and, you know, Maya and all that, to find a poem that could fit in her body and her mouth that she could recite and, you know, do it. And so I wanted to have that tradition inside of the book. So there are winks to multiple poets inside of the book. The beginning poem is, you know, Who Will You Say You Are, which is a wink to Amiri Baraka when it says, Who Will Serve America? You know, so there's all sorts of things in there. And there's also a play of visual poetry in there. There's a gentrification poem, and the poem is laid out like a neighborhood. And then there's a poem for Serena Williams about race, when the controversy of, you know, should she be sports person of the year, when folks wanted American Pharoah, the thoroughbred horse, to win. So the poem is structured like a race track. And how it's structured is that it's a constant loop. You can read it over and over again. The notion, the feeling that, you know, racism is this constant loop that never ends.
All right, y'all, we got to get into this reading. But before we do, a quick description of Kelly's book, Freedom Knows My Name. It is a journey of personal and collective freedom through the lens of a Black woman. Kelly, it's all yours.
For Bender Avenue Girls, East Cleveland. Chalk names on concrete squares warn the world. Step to us with a bouquet of respect. We live here too, among blades of boys and broken classroom windows. After school, the smell of urine and flirty old men filled the streets. Fast girls, cause we gotta be moving like a unit of soldiers, ready to pull knives, jump rope, fences, shooing dog sights. We still walk a factory smoke, braid hair like a Mary J. album, our laughter loud and lonely, eligible for living on blocks where cheese and children get chopped into sections of eight. Can folks tell stories in kitchens of Alabama and burning crosses? We are daughters of runaway Negroes, still bent fields of yesterday, maps of our mothers veined in our palms. We catch buses and side eyes while searching for the same North Star that brought us here. We survive like every bad mayor elected, pretend our tears are hard laughs. Word on the street is our bodies flow easy. No daddy stand guard at our doors, but we cross our arms into Black girl stance under street lights, popping gum like warning shots.
So for Bender Avenue girls in Cleveland, I'm from Chicago.
Okay.
Originally, my family's from the West, but I'm from Chicago. Grew up on the South Side, so I was like, oh. And then when it ended, popping gun like warning shots, I was like, damn. Whole childhood just right there.
I'm trying to, you know, as I think the poem was about that personal struggle for freedom, however people define it, and particularly through a Black woman's lens and the collective freedom that we have. And I feel that particularly Black women are oftentimes trying to help the collective at the expense of themselves. And they're trying to find that balance. And so we're like chronic caretakers, you know, constantly trying to care for multiple people, multiple issues. And so the book is trying to, it's trying to capture all of that tension, whether it's, you know, talking about the poem about salt and pepper, where I'm talking about how my mother would not let me even come near that Push It song, you know, at that time. And using that to talk about how Black girls are seen as fast, you know, that whole concept of, you know, being too grown and being fast and all of those things. So it jumps around a little bit, but I feel like it's what I would want to read. It's what my aesthetic is. And so I'm happy that I was able to free myself to get here.
You can do another.
Okay. Since you're from Chicago and, you know, we both have Midwest roots, I'll do migration, my family, my Cleveland, the story of thinking about migration in my own family. Left your land for a job, that same Southern job, the always job of surviving white folks. Working hard ain't never impress them. Why a farmer like you go north? The land is hitched to steel in tight-lipped mornings. No elbow room for joy. No time to rock the earth asleep. Had a porch, a pulpit then. Stories sprouted from dirt and spirit. Here ain't by the riverside. Don't flow back to ancient gospels. God is a check here. A blue collar, a few days off. Remember those clockless days when soil called you to work? I reckon it's worth leaving the land if heaven is up, away from cotton, away from the wrong white people, hoping to find the right ones. Maybe up there, clan fires fade in rear view and trees dangle the weight of snow. How'd you learn to live in the cold and rude and disrespect? They don't sip nothing sweet up here. Lynched us with good, bad jobs, and better than Mississippi hope. Brick by brick, stacking generations of heavy breathers of smoke, polite anger. I weep for all the times the Navy called you boy, all the middle fingers you should have raised, all the labor half the paycheck, all the white flight that left big city rats eating the floorboards nailed from your knees, your blood in the wood, your blood in the wood have been. I live the same two-step blues of kinfolk made in the Delta, integrated with white children whose parents were the white people that niggered you. How many miles did you travel to be more than fractions of a dream? Grandpa, did you ever cross the Dixie again in your sleep? Mm. Did you ever bring America home?
Ooh. I wrote that one down when I listened to it, when you, the line, the white folks who niggered you. But in thinking of migration, both of my parents are from New Orleans, and then they both moved to Chicago separately, I believe, and reconnected. Even now, I live in Florida, and much of my work is about the South. My last book was about New Orleans. My next book is now for the Academy. It's going to be about New Orleans. Yes. And so it makes me think of Charles M. Blow, whose book recently came out, The Devil You Know, mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. his whole hypothesis that, you know, Black people leave the North, come back to the South, create a voting bloc, let's take over, let's do it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But from you being from Cleveland and now living in New Orleans and in the South, how do those migration patterns, or even Charles Blow's theory that, you know, this is home, no matter how painful it is, and the same pain we find in the South, you find in the North, is just different, kind of. Yeah. I don't even know what the question is at this point. I noticed that thread, and I guess I want your thoughts on it. Let's go with that. It's open.
Sure. Living in the South has allowed me to look back at my family's experience in the North with a deeper understanding and appreciation for the choices that they made, and also the generational poverty that our family had. Because now I'm looking back and I'm saying, okay, they were trying to make a better life. They bought into, you know, this thing about being North. And now the place that I used to live, you know, like East Cleveland, I talked about that in the poem, Bender Avenue Girls. Well, my grandparents moved into East Cleveland when it was like hard for Black folks to get in. They saved all their money. They wanted their kids to go to great schools. And then my father, he graduates from the high school, and it's like, it's still kind of mixed, but it's a little more Black. And then my brother, once he comes along, it's all Black. Right. And so I can now I think about it more in terms of all the different policies that were in place on our people, that although our people weren't in the South, where they were seeing kind of the discrimination and the racism, you know, vividly in front of them, the North had it more systematically, if you will. And so, like, now I'm looking back, like, it's the same thing, you know, the same white people that niggered us in the South is the same ones in the North, but in very kind of their approaches and their strategies, you know. And it also makes me think that white folks got a lot of different strategies inside of them. They got strategies about strategies, you know. When we think about racism, and while they're strategizing, we're like always trying to survive. You know, that's the thing that's happening in New Orleans now. Like, now that stuff is opening back up, you know, I'm looking around, driving around, like, we all weren't social distancing, because y'all asses is building condos, you know, like left and right all around the city while we sitting in the house trying to stay safe. And so it's, so yeah, the South and the North are both kindred. And so many things that I did not think about when I was living in the North that were Southern. You know, my mom is from the South, and she migrated, you know, North and met my dad and all those things, but she kept all her vernacular. So growing up, you know, although I was like in the North, my mama was always saying, girl, you know, stutton, you know, all of these like Southern things. She was always talking to us that way, you know, every Friday she was cooking fish. And I didn't even like get it until I moved to the South. Like, oh, we was having fish fries, you know, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, the South and the South and North are always, we always return home. We always return home at some point, whether it's in our cooking, whether it's in our storytelling, whether it's in the way we wash clothes, the way we do our greens. You know, I have never heard so many different versions of how to do greens until I got to New Orleans. But I've been here for, you know, a while now, a long time. And I think New Orleans helped me get my sound back. And it gave me permission to play on the page again. And I'm trying as best I can. All art is an attempt. But I often go back to Toni Morrison when she says, we do language. And I want to do language as best I can. And I want to do it with all types of audiences, you know, my academic folks, my, you know, my janitor, you know, my...
the man in the po' boy shop.
Yeah, the man in the shop, everywhere. You know, I want to do language. And so that's really where I'm at with it. And like I said, I feel peace. And I'm not in competition with anybody. And I've embraced this notion that it's not my job to be successful. It's my job to create. And the people can decide what success is. But for me, you know, I just want to create as much as possible and leave it for, you know, whomever to consume and think about, talk about, write about.
One of the poems I loved was "The Lady Next Door is Yelling." And there are two lines that caught me. The first was, I know this woman because I once didn't know myself, which is like basically to me saying, I know this woman because I was this woman once. I've been that lady on the phone yelling at the man early in the morning about why he ain't no good and he trifling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other line was, the last line, her tears drying one cigarette at a time. And that visual was so clear for me in my head. Like I could see her on the porch with the cigarette and like a full slip or a house dress and smoking a cigarette, trying to just get it back together because she didn't act crazy on the phone this morning. The whole neighborhood heard. And now she's gonna pull it together for whatever her day is going to be. And so even in talking about what could have been a painful situation, you paint the situation so colorfully that it's a universal experience.
I hope so. I'm trying to. You know, I had so much anxiety when the book came out. I was just like, oh my God, it's out. I can't take it back. You know, I was just, you know, so afraid. But it's been doing well. It's been received well. You know, I couldn't, you know, have a book that has freedom in the title and not really try to free myself as best I can.
But in talking about that freedom, because what I notice is that, yes, it's freedom for all Black people, but it's specifically from the point of view of Black women and girls.
Mm-hmm. I want to be my authentic Black girl, Black woman self. But I just want to make sure more than anything that it represented me and that it was, if you will, I'm trying to make it a gift to Black women and to Black folks. And not that I don't want white people to read it, you know, but it was important to me that I prioritize the spirit of our folks first.
There were a couple other lines that stuck out to me, and I want to address them before we start to wrap up our interview. And the birds and the bees be revolution. You said somewhere Black people are making forever. You think Black culture is global culture and is eternal?
Yes, I do. Because we've survived so many hills, so many horrific things. We have survived, and it is forever. You know. And in this pandemic, one of the most amazing things happened to me. My aunt, which is kind of odd. I hope we have time for this. You can cut it however you want. But my aunt tells me one day, you know, because my book comes out, she says, you should talk to Uncle David. Uncle David is your grandmother's brother. And I'm like, my grandmother's brother? I didn't even think any of her siblings could even be alive, right? You know, like, how are y'all sitting on the fact that this man is alive, right? You know, and don't tell nobody. So she's like, yeah, he's in California. Call him. So I'm like, I got to call him right away because, you know, if he's my grandmother's brother, because, you know, my grandmother died in like her 70s. So I find out that they're like 22 years or so apart. So I call him and I'm nervous and I'm like, he says, hello. I say, hi, I'm Willie Eva's granddaughter. I'm Kelly. I'm Eddie's daughter, your nephew. And he pauses. He says, oh, how you doing? What's going on? You know, I'm like, okay. And I'm like, I want to ask him all these questions because, you know, he's like the last one, but I know he's old. So he's like 91, right? But he's sharp. He's like, do you want to do a Zoom? I'm like, a Zoom? Okay. You know, okay, Uncle David. So he's telling me all these things. And he's like, what do you do? And I say, well, I write poetry, but I'm not really claiming my writership. Cause I'm like, no, does he appreciate that I'm a writer? You know? And he says, well, you got it honest. He says, our grandmother, which would be my great grandmother, Genevieve, wanted to be a poet. And he says she was the entertainment in this little neighborhood in Alabama. People would come into the front room and she would stand in the middle of the room and recite poetry. And I tears just started coming down my face. Like, are you kidding me? Are you serious? And he's like, yeah, she wants to do poetry in church, but her pastor put her out, you know, because when it was testimony time, she would just get up and do a poem. You know, she would like try to slide it in, you know. And he's telling me all these amazing stories of her doing poetry. And he said it was her life's dream to be a poet. And so he says to me, whether you know it or not, you finally put the punctuation on it. And so he says, yeah, call my daughter. I'm going to text her to call you. What's your number? So his daughter calls me, this cousin that I don't know. And she's like, yeah, she was this amazing poet. She would tell us poems before we went to bed and all of these things. And we're in a battle with somebody about this house she grew up in, but a lot of her stuff is still there. And when we can legally clear it, you can go in, come down to Alabama and, you know, look through some of her stuff. And I was just so like, the pandemic would have never brought that up because people just started thinking about life differently and family and connecting. And so now I feel that this poetry is so sacred now in ways that I could not have imagined. And so, you know, one plants and another waters. So when like we have on t-shirts that say, I am my ancestor's wildest dream, like that.
Literally.
It is real. And so I just give thanks for that moment. And I feel like that is, that's the bookend to really what I want to say. Yeah.
I don't even care about my other questions now. let's go to the speed round and we'll get to the last question. Sure. All right. What is your favorite book?
Depends on what day. But I often go back to Their Eyes Were Watching God.
Mm. Someone else who did language. Mm-hmm. There's a theme here. I'm seeing it. Who is your favorite author?
That's hard too. Sonia Sanchez comes to mind.
Who is your favorite musical artist?
Oh, James Brown, I would say.
And what is your favorite song?
I don't have a favorite. It depends on what day. I can go James Brown, D'Angelo, Erykah Badu, jazz, you know.
What is it today for when you go in this kitchen and make dinner?
I'll probably listen to some Sweet Honey in the Rock. Yeah.
Name one poet who doesn't get enough recognition.
Harriet Mullen.
And you kind of touched on this before, but what is the difference between poetry and spoken word?
I don't know. I mean, I guess the performance aspects of it. But I think we are form. We are form. And so I don't see as much of a difference. I think it's just about doing what the poem requires.
What do you love the most about living in New Orleans?
The people. Oh my God, the people. They're wonderful. They're like family, you know. Yeah, the people, definitely, for sure.
What sound brings you joy?
My daughter laughing. She's got a funny laugh. She's got a funny laugh. You know how some people laugh and then you start laughing? It's like that. Yeah. Yeah.
What is your favorite New Orleans dish?
If it's done right, gumbo. If it's done right, yeah.
I love that caveat. If it's done right. What does freedom look like to you?
Freedom looks like being healthy, being at peace, having balance in life between your professional goals, your duties of paying bills and all that stuff, and like everyday joy, finding the everyday joy in moments. I think that it's a continuum. So that's what freedom looks like to me. What I thought was freedom and what I wanted in my 20s is very different now. So it's always evolving for me.
All right. And then our final question for the interview today. You have been basically assigned a life of language and poetry. When you are among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about your writing legacy that you left behind?
I think that I was intentional about kind of taking down the literary walls between academic and non-MFA folks and community and college, and that I tried to embody and bring it all together, bring all of that together, right? And that I was a good steward of the word, of words, of poetry, and that I was one voice in conversation with another or many.
Thank you, Kelly. This has been a treat.
Thank you. Thank you.
Big shout out to Kelly Harris DeBerry for being here on Black and Published today. Make sure you check out Kelly's poetry collection, Freedom Knows My Name. And if you're not following Kelly, follow her on the socials. She's at KHD Poetry on Twitter and Instagram. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to the Instagram page. It's at Black and Published. That's BLK and Published. I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Kelly about how she nearly missed her chance to get into the Cave Canem Fellowship. It's up right now. Again, that's our show. I'll holler at y'all next week. Peace.